I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. In July 2004, an up-and-coming Illinois state senator named Barack Obama gave a stirring keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention.
E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
Obama's vision of a united America feels almost quaint by today's standards. A September Gallup poll found that 80% of adults believe that Americans are deeply divided on our most important values. The close presidential election this year reveals very different views of and beliefs about the country. The polarization and partisan antipathy that were a part of the race show no signs of cooling off. So, how do we break through these political barriers? How do we talk with and listen to people with whom we disagree? How do we find common ground and connect across our differences? It's not easy, but it can be done. Let me introduce our two guests. Bill Doherty is a clinical psychologist, works as a marriage and family therapist. He's one of the founders of Braver Angels, an organization that works to bridge the partisan divide through workshops held across the country. He's professor emeritus at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Family Social Science. And Bill Doherty, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Great to be with you.
And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Leah Howard. She's a political scientist who heads up the Political Empathy Lab. That's an initiative of the Stavros Niarchos Foundation's Padilla program. She and University of Pennsylvania students traveled across the Commonwealth this summer to talk with strangers about politics. The lab's podcast reveals what they learned by listening for understanding. And Leah Howard, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
So great to be here.
Bill, let me start with you. We certainly have had intense political disagreements before. We fought a civil war. We've had anti-war protests, civil rights demonstrations through our history. Is there something new and different about today's divisive political environment?
Well, I think there is in terms of the political identity. Political affiliation has become part of our identities, you know, red versus blue. And this is replacing some identities like religious identity. So as a powerful marker of who we are, what our values are, who our clan is. And so this has been rising now for 40 years or so, and really, you know, hopefully peaking at this point, maybe not go too much further. So it's fairly unique that we have this degree of political polarization, red and blue.
Even though, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but even though our political parties seem to be losing members, so it's an interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, so what the political scientists, and Leah's a political scientist, talk about is it's not that we love our own side more, so people don't love their own party, it's out-party hate. Who's the enemy? The parties are not terribly strong, but we now know who we don't like.
Well, let's talk about, I guess, the intensity of feeling. And I wonder, Leah, how much you think social media just drives this antipathy.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I completely agree with what Bill was sharing. And you're right, as ideology and identity have fused in this really interesting way, it's created what political scientists call affective polarization. So you just feel intense feelings towards co-partisans, the people that are with you. You love them. And then the people that you're against, you know, the other side. So where media knows this and, right, can feed and prime and continue that cycle. So the othering thing just keeps happening, and people are primed for that more. And then are not, you know, even when you engage in listening, you're listening for cues, quick things that you can tell whether you're with them or against them.
I mean, it feels very tribal.
Yes, Right. It is. And so that feels also, it's not priming you as a person to deep listening or deep thought. It's priming you towards more warlike behaviors, right? Getting in, you know, defense or offense and being, you know, not bridging, you know?
Well, but let me go back to you. Is there something that we then enjoy about hating the other side that might be making it a little too strong, but sort of pointing out the foibles of the other side, that it makes us feel good about our side?
Yeah, and this is, you know, part of human nature, unfortunately, you know, my tribe and your tribe. It's just that where does it show itself? You know, in sports, it can show itself in a, you know, often in a healthy way, right? We used to in this country do much more of this tribalizing by religion. Okay, so, you know, interfaith marriages, okay, kind of like, whoa. Now, and I always like to point out this bit of data, that in 1960, only, according to the polls, only 5% of Americans said they would be uncomfortable with their son or daughter marrying somebody of the other political party. Okay, now it's up to 40 to 45% wow. who would be unhappy about somebody marrying in. So it really, the one of the indicators of an other, as Leah was saying, is that I wouldn't want them around my table Thanksgiving or be the, you know, father of my grandchildren. So it's so this political difference. And of course, one of the reasons it's so important is that we have to run a country together.
Right. Right. And I do want to pick up on running a country together, but Leah, let me go back to you and just picking up on what Bill said about the kind of distance that people feel from each other and the kind of finger pointing. So if we don't know you, because we've decided you're on the other team, how does that lead to even greater polarization?
Well, it just keeps reinforcing itself. What Bill just shared about not wanting to marry, that same kind of research is around, like, you don't want to work with people of the opposite party. You don't want to even share sports conversation with them. There's all different things that people, political scientists have measured. You don't want to be them. So you're isolating yourself. You're not actually knowing context or anything else. You're just knowing what you're told. Again, you were talking about media by your source, your information source about that other. You're not actually knowing things about real, live, enfleshed people that are that other. So it's this reinforcing silosation and separation, isolation. And you add that to a loneliness epidemic that we're experiencing, and all of a sudden you have not a lot of, like, real lived experience. You have a lot of thoughts about, you know.
Well, I wonder, Bill, whether then polarization has made us lonelier.
Well, I think so. I think when we feel when you lop off half of the country as people you can have connections with. And then when you do that in your family, so I'm a family therapist, so I pay a lot of attention to that. So there are people who are important in our lives. And one of the things that's happening is this polarization has entered family life. You know, the thing about extended families, you don't choose them. So we can choose our work, we can choose our neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. But you don't choose your in-laws, you know, your cousins and so on. And so families have become a pressure cooker now for this, with people boycotting, you know, Thanksgiving, you know, with people cutting each other off, going silent, having coalitions. You know, so I've worked with families where, you know, there's one of the adult kids has gone rogue because the family was always liberal and that's a conservative, vice versa. So it gets all caught up in these family dynamics and it can be very painful.
Well, let me throw a political science question at you, Leah, because it does feel as if we live in very different political worlds. We don't agree. There's a lot we do not agree, factual information that we don't agree on. We can't even have a conversation because we don't agree on X, Y, and Z.
That's right. Yeah.
But where did that come from? Is it just sort of part of this tribal disengagement?
Well, I think it's tribal disengagement, and you add the overlay of, you know, just a media world now where people have so many choices of what they listen to and what their information is, and then, you know, what their facts are. I mean, there's just so much that feeds so many other things that feed this. I think also the speed. I talk to students a lot about the speed of the soundbite, how we don't have patience to, because we get information so rapidly. And, you know, what leads Google is the most popular, not necessarily the most right or correct or factual. So people just don't have the patience to really think about what difference means. And so it makes us more reactive, I think. And we just think we know quickly, you know, and we don't necessarily.
And we don't necessarily know.
Right?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up.
Go ahead, Bill. Yeah, go ahead.
Because what I hear a lot from folks is that, you know, how can you even have a conversation about a politics and policy if you can't agree on the facts?
Right.
And so then that contributes to not even engaging in the conversation. And so some of it, as Leah was saying, is that our media environment, because we get a lot of our information from media, and some of your listeners are old enough like me to remember there were three net TV networks and, you know, public television. And you know, Walter Cronkite, the iconic, at the end of his broadcast, he would say, and that's the way it is. You know, September 15th, you know, and more or less, that's what we thought it was. Okay. Now, I don't want to romanticize that because there was maybe too much homogeneity and all that. But now we have specialized sources of news and information that cater to our own biases. And so we live in different fact universes. And then I hadn't really thought about you, what you were saying is that the speed. We don't need even as many facts anymore, any enough information. We can just like quickly form opinions. And then we live in different information worlds, which makes it very hard to communicate about policy.
Well, I'm about a minute before our first break here. But so, Leah, picking up on what both you and Bill are saying is we do these kind of shorthand conversations. So if you use certain language, then I say, ah, okay, you're a conservative, you're a liberal, you're a what?
Right. No, and things are so, I also just want to add too to what Bill was saying about how media itself then becomes infused with emotion and certain facts that all of a sudden, or certain moments in time where you have to have a quick view on it, you know, and that's so emotionally laden, you know, and that makes for a tricky time as well with absorbing the information that's so either your information is priming you for like fear or anger, or it's priming you for sadness or depression or cynicism. And so, you know, people know they would need to be informed, but they're taking an emotional pill when they're being informed, you know, and then that makes the next conversation infused with that emotion, I feel like, as well. So.
Well, we have a lot to talk about after this very short break. And let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. That's Leah Howard. She's a political scientist, heads up the Political Empathy Lab, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania. Bill Daugherty is a clinical psychologist, one of the founders of Braver Angels. And we're talking about the fact that there is so much that seems to divide us as Americans and talking about how to talk across some of these political divides. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We are talking about the divide between people with different political opinions, why it's as wide as ever, increasingly viewing each other with mistrust and even ridicule. This, of course, can lead to never-ending conflicts and estrangement. Is this any way to run a country? We're talking with clinical psychologist William Daugherty and political scientist Leah Howard. And Bill, you wanted to say something in response to what Leah was saying right before the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was just in addition to what Leah was saying that polarization has been rising in this country well before Donald Trump. One might actually say that he's a product of that and not just the instigator of it. And it's been a phenomenon happening all over the world in the democracies, you know, England and Germany and France and Canada and so on. And it's been accompanied by a rise in distrust of social institutions, you know, starting back in the 70s, where most people thought, you know, the courts, the police, the schools, the medicine, you know, these are pretty good people, government. But there's been a steady decline in trust of and respect for institutions and in one another. Leah talked about the loneliness epidemic. We are much less trusting of our fellow neighbors. So this creates, and then you have income inequality, you have social media, you have all of this stuff that's been going on for some time. And then you have Trump comes along at a particular moment where this coalesces, but it's a bigger issue. And I'm stressing that because anybody who thinks that our problems with polarization are going to go away when Donald Trump goes away is misguided.
Well, I wonder, picking up on that, and Leah, going back to you, whether you think we also have a political system that sort of drives mistrust, a system driven in part by capitalism, by winners and losers, by a political system where it's sort of minority rule. Take something like gun control or gun safety. Most people in this country want sensible gun control, and yet we cannot get that from our political leaders.
It's really, really tricky, and I appreciate what Bill said by bringing in all the different things at this moment, because I do think the erosion of trust is connected with kind of our lack of faith in norms. So many of our, you know, the things in our Constitution are dependent upon norms that people uphold. And when those norms are not upheld, and when people don't trust that the system really works, this erodes everything and then leads to narratives that people, I think certain political operatives can manipulate certain narratives that make real change not happen, you know, around policy issues like gun control or gun reform or that people feel passionate about and there's actual, you know, evidence behind and all sorts of things. I do think so much of our system relies on norms and relies on trust.
Well, and I wonder too whether, and I think a lot of people feel a kind of learned helplessness. And, you know, over time when you get zapped time and time again, you kind of give up and there's a kind of sense of throwing up our hands and saying, well, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and you know, we don't have high voting rates in this country, right? And then I think a lot of Democrats who are strongly opposed to Trump are kind of in this sort of giving up state at the moment. Now, whether that will change or not, but it's and so what I like to say to that as we think about solutions is that I think we overfocus on what happens in Washington. And there's a lot more potential for people to come together across differences at the local level. We only focus on Washington. Oh, my goodness.
Well, and Leah, you and a group of students this summer went across Pennsylvania, that, you know, considered, I guess, the battleground state this election season for the presidency, and talked to people, talked to strangers about what? Politics? About issues.
Exactly. And I'm really glad that Bill set me up so nicely for
he
that
did.
Because he just really, I mean, people do feel this helplessness and lack of agency. And my students, I mean, this is year after year, as they think about climate change or other things, they just feel immobilized by the intensity of the problem. But if you bring it to the local, you bring it to the person, you bring it to the grassroots, one conversation, an N of one, I'm always saying, like, it's worth it to have that. You feel a tremendous sense of agency. So yeah, this summer, it was May 28th to August 2nd, 10 weeks, 7 students and myself. We covered 2,500 miles just around Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So like driving to Arizona from Philadelphia. And we just drove around the state.
It's a beautiful state.
It's a beautiful state and filled with beautiful people. And we had amazing conversations. And people, my students, and myself, our eyes were opened. We were so surprised by the just what human connection feels like.
Well, and I do want to talk more about that, but let me just toss something at you, Bill. And we've been kind of diagnosing the problem, but not coming up with solutions yet. But I wonder, as a family therapist, as a clinical psychologist, should we then think of our country as a giant family of 340 million people, that we are a family that has to figure out how to live together?
Yeah, I think we make a mistake if we think of democracy as only something that happens, you know, out there, you know, with legislative systems and executive branch and all that. I really think of democracy as what we the people do to solve problems together.
Right.
And some of those might be a bike lane. And some of those might be the local homeless shelter and what we do there. In Braver Angels, the organization I helped to found in 2016, we really emphasized both what Leah was saying, and that is that people coming together in groups and small, and pairs, and also what kinds of solutions we can find on the ground that we can do something about.
Well, let's talk about Braver Angels, and this is bringing people with different political beliefs together to talk, I guess, together about what? Life, about politics, about themselves. Where do you start in a conversation like this?
Well, let me back up a little bit. We got started right after the 2016 presidential election, kind of on the spur of the moment, when my colleague David Blankenhorn was on the phone with a colleague. David Blankenhorn lives in New York City, David Lapp, another colleague in Southwest Ohio, and they were talking about how differently people were feeling about that election. In New York City, the world was ending. And in Southwest Ohio, it was morning in America. And so they decided on the spur of the moment to get 10 Hillary Clinton voters and 10 Donald Trump voters together for 13 hours over a weekend in Southwest Ohio, December of 2016, when passions are so high. And they called me and asked me if I would facilitate it. I was actually pretty daunted about
I
that.
bet.
I was hoping I was not free. Oh, I would have loved to do it, but,
Too bad, yeah.
So I just pulled in everything I ever knew, both about from therapy world and group dynamics, and we had an amazing experience. And I thought that would be one off, but we decided to keep going. And so, and we decided to form an organization we call Braver Angels, nonprofit, that where the leadership is half red, half blue. Right from the beginning. So our board, our leadership team, we have what we call alliances or chapters across the country. There are several in the Pennsylvania, by the way, in the Philly area. Again, the leadership is half conservative, half liberal, and independents as well. So there's something about coming together to tackle what I think is the central problem of our time, and that is polarization. The reason I say it's the central problem is we can't get anything else done if we can't tackle that. But it's our joint problem. And so that's what's the essence of Braver Angels. We're working, not just doing feel-good conversations. We're trying to solve a problem.
Is it about changing people's minds, or is it about understanding why someone believes or behaves a certain way?
Yeah, the way we think of it is we're not trying to change minds about policy and politicians. We're trying to help people change their minds about each other.
So
Okay.
where do you
And
start? How do you start that
You
conversation?
start with listening. You start with questions. So in one of our workshops, we have people in small groups. It's called a fishbowl. You get the reds or the blues in the middle first, and then the other group is on chairs on the outside listening. And the questions for the group in the middle are, why are your side's values and policies good for the country? And then the second question is, what are your reservations or concerns about your own side? We call that the humility question, okay? And the group on the outside are just listening and trying to understand how these folks see the world. And then you flip, okay, the group on the inside and the outside. And then they gather afterwards to process it. And the processing questions are, what did you learn about people on the other side, how they see themselves, and did you see anything in common? And the discipline of this is we train the moderators. That's all you can talk about at that point, and people agree on the ground rules. So if you create spaces where you have some good ground rules, some good containers, and people express themselves and offer humility, magic happens.
Well, you have a something you call democratic listening, Leah, which sounds very similar to what Bill is talking
Yeah,
about.
we're so aligned, Bill. Like as you're talking, I'm like, yes. Democratic listening, and it's not just me. It's a, the political science world is starting to do a lot more with this. So deliberative democracy as a, field of study has focused so much on speech, and has neglected listening. And really, how do you study listening is this new question, but for a democracy to be fully a democracy, there needs to be uptake. There needs to be listening of all the different views. And so what does that look like, and how does that feel? And so to me, it was such an interesting experience this summer to have students experiment with listening, not just for belief, not just for people to have consensus around belief, but for you to really understand my students, I talk a lot about how belief drives so much of our belonging quickly. But what if you then focus a little bit more on your behavior instead of the belief? When you meet another person, think about how you are indicating that you're listening and what your behaviors are, and allow that to kind of connect you and drive your belonging, and then get to your beliefs. It's not that the beliefs don't matter. It's that you're not sorting your belonging around the nexus of belief. You're doing it around how you behave and you're connecting and thinking about that.
When you're talking then about that kind of listening and the behavior, I mean, and I'm listening to the two of you, but I'm also have these thoughts going on in my head. I mean, it is so hard to turn off all the noise, all the opinions that we have.
So hard. And so for what we talked a lot about is slowing it down. So you're slowing down the conversation so you can listen to the conversation you're having in your head while you, like you were just saying, while the other person's talking. So you're not so reactive because you're taking a minute to say, how did it feel when someone said that to me? You know, and so you can really think about that. And you're not as sensitive to the moment, to reactive, because you're really experimenting with how that felt, because you're creating what I called it for my students is strategies of connection. How do you connect with people? So and we each have our own. You know, we've got some general ones, obviously, humility, what Bill talked about, listening with humility. I don't have all the answers. Listening with curiosity. What must that be like to think that way? I don't know. These are like practices that have to be, you know, worked out like you're in a gym, because they're not really reinforced by the culture in which we live.
I'm thinking, Bill, about the head and the heart. You know, our head is always like, you know, things are like flying around our brain, and our heart is often doing something else.
Of course. And so there are skills to do this. And one of them is acknowledging, paraphrasing back what somebody said, because if I'm going to summarize what I heard you said, I actually have to listen to you, okay? As opposed to, preparing my brilliant retort for what you said.
Exactly.
And also something we've learned is that behind every strong political belief, there's a story. If somebody in your life, okay, so listeners are at the holiday season, but if there's somebody like, they're a gladiator for or against Trump or immigration or whatever, okay, there's a story there, okay? It comes out of a story. And so we've learned that you can ask, instead of somebody, why do you think that way? How did you come to believe such and such? How did you come to your view? How did you get there? Invites a story. And when you can get the stories, you get to the values and you have a real life person as opposed to a talking point that they come from.
Or even a kind of stereotype that we often have about the other side, that the reason they believe X, Y, and Z is because, you know, they don't know anything, or they don't care about anything. But you're saying if someone has a story, there's a reason why they believe what they believe.
Yes. And it humanizes them to you, okay? But you have to, as Leah was saying, you have to go into that conversation without the goal of making your point, okay? I have relatives from all over the country, and some of them are from the South, and so my in-laws, we get together in Minnesota, this very blue state, of course, and so I say to my relative from Texas, well, I always begin with, what are people in your part of the country saying about X, Y, Z? Okay. And then he's happy to tell me what they think. And he tells me what he thinks are yahoos and what's the good. And then I listen. I'm like an anthropologist. I'm curious. Okay. And then I find something to agree with. So that's another thing. Mm-hmm. There's almost something you can agree with, even if, like immigration, the system is broken. Everybody agrees on that. Okay.
Right.
If we could be talking about children's education in the public schools. We all want our children to be educated. So listen for the story and then find something to agree with, and then you're locked in. So, Leah, one of our principles that you were just expressing so beautifully is connect first before you disagree. Connect before you disagree.
Because you're saying, I care about you, I'm interested in you. We're, you know, we might believe things differently, but we're both, what, human beings?
Yeah. And another phrase we like to use is achieving accurate disagreement. okay, as opposed to distorted disagreement. Most arguments are, I'm arguing against my sense of what you believe and why you believe it, not your own, okay? But accurate disagreement means we actually listen well enough so that we know where we disagree. And paradoxically, that opens up areas of agreement.
Hmm.
When you have accurate disagreement.
Yes, no, I hear that, and I can almost feel it as well. Leah, is there a connection then between curiosity and empathy?
Oh, I think so. I think, well, first of all, to empathy, the culture in which we live, I think right now, this moment, I think atrophies empathy. So just all the ways you can crack in and reanimate and make empathy alive, which means the desire to understand when I say empathy, as opposed to convert people to your view and your tribe. So I think curiosity can drive and help develop and help soften your ability to go towards empathy and understand. So again, so much of what Bill was saying was resonating with me. And when he was talking about stories, by traveling around Pennsylvania, we were almost walking into new stories. Like, first of all, we were destabilizing what we thought we knew about places, which really, it's pretty little what we knew. We just had this like vague impression of what, you know,
these people are like that.
Exactly. And you fill in the blank. Pennsylvania has rural spots. It has like post-industrial. It has, you know, very wooded spots that are, you know, so many different things. And so when we'd walk into a county fair in the middle of, you know, Troy, Pennsylvania, the Troy County Fair, we were like walking into a story. There were new things to notice and new people to experience. And then we'd start talking to people. And again, like Bill was saying, we tried to establish some kind of common ground, whether it's, I really like the soft pretzels over there that they're selling.
Something
delicious,
as simple as that.
Delicious. They agreed. And then we're off to hearing their story. We found early on that sometimes when we led with, we're the political empathy lab, people turned off. So we started leading with like, what issues are important to you living in this area? And that opened up story, floodgates of story, and we're hooked. I think the human brain loves stories, like, you know, and you're just like, yay. And you're curious because you're like, stories. Yes. Good. So yeah, I agreed.
And then comes the empathy. Let's take that very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And that is Leah Howard. She heads up the Political Empathy Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. William Doherty is with us as well. He is a clinical psychologist and one of the founders of Braver Angels, an organization that works to bridge the partisan divide. And we are talking about how we can listen better and disagree better and connect across our differences. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about how we can overcome our political divisions. And again, our guests are Bill Doherty, co-founder of Braver Angels, a nonprofit that seeks to restore trust, respect, and goodwill in American politics. He's also professor emeritus of family social science at the University of Minnesota. Leah Thomas teaches in the political science department at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Political Empathy Lab, and which focuses about how to dialogue across differences. How important, Leah, is it to, if you want to try to understand someone, is to be with them in the flesh, person to person?
I think it's tremendously important, especially as you're learning political empathy. It's really important because, so there's cognitive empathy, there's emotional empathy, there's empathic concern. It really helps when you are looking at the person and listening to the person and around the person, as opposed to, again, and this was with my students, I saw it in particular, there's so many nonverbal cues, there's so many things that just come through that allow you to connect in a certain way. And my students don't have the same amount of contact with strangers that maybe earlier generations did. So I found it tremendously important to be face to face.
You agree with that, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. And could I take us on a little bit of a different direction
You
at the
sure
moment?
can, sure.
So I'm sort of channeling the audience, and I'm thinking about people out there who are wondering why should they try to do these things we're talking about. I don't know if you're going there, but I'm feeling
I
compelled to
had it in
address.
my back pocket, but no,
There we go.
go for it.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking something. Oh, this is so nicey, nicey, and part of what I want to say is that we are in serious trouble in this country, and we are seriously divided. Every election is 51-49, and then the people who get are 51 think they have a mandate, and then usually crash and burn, and then the other group comes in. We are in a stalemate, and if we don't figure out how to communicate across our differences better, we are in for a long time. So there's a pragmatic reason as well as a kind of an ethical and a reason to do what we're talking about here, because if we don't start listening and figuring out common ground, this is going to go on and on and on. So that's the pragmatics of this.
Well, and I'm also imagining people saying, yeah, but why should I talk to someone who has these hateful, horrible beliefs? I
Exactly.
mean, unless I can change their mind, I don't want to have anything to do with them. What do we do about that?
Yeah, so part of what I say about that is that something I learned in this work for the last 8 years is to not assume that a policy difference means that we occupy different moral universes. So somebody may be very distressed about immigration and illegal immigration and say things that I think are very disrespectful. Just take any issue.
Sure.
If we disagree, like affirmative action or whatever, climate change. What I realized I was doing before I got into this work was I was assuming that if I'm for some form of affirmative action and you're against it, that you don't want people to have equal opportunity in this country. Okay. And that therefore you have the moral low ground. Okay. And then I, of course, feel superior. Well, why would I even talk to you? Whereas what I've learned is that generally at the level of the highest values that every American should be able to flourish here if they want to work hard, okay? That all of our children deserve a good education, that everybody should have access to good health care. At the level of those highest aspirations and values, we are closer than we realize. We differ sharply on policy and how to get there. But distinguishing those means I don't judge somebody's heart in the way that I used to.
And yet we seem to be in a kind of stasis or paralysis, Lee, in terms of, as Bill was saying, yeah, maybe we can agree on a lot of issues, but we don't know how to get there. And this is our political system, I think, in large part.
Yeah, most
And
definitely.
maybe our media system as well.
Well, right. And as Bill was talking, I was thinking also about when you have conversations with someone and you are willing to listen and willing to be challenged, and you have intellectual humility that you don't have all the answers. You also get to complexify your own views, and you might not have answered every little bit of your own view. You kind of take it, you've taken parts of your view on faith. Like I'm against climate change, and you just have a very vague sense of the details. When you're talking to someone who disagrees with you on an issue, like say they don't believe climate change is real, you work out each piece of your own belief with another person, because and you have to think critically about questions they're asking you that you maybe have not asked yourself. And maybe your, media silo hasn't asked you either. So you don't have a very nuanced and interesting set of beliefs. When you're working with someone else, you're working out and complexifying your own belief. So I think there's tons of value, but you just have to take on that intellectual humility. I may not be right. And a little bit of taking back your identity and your beliefs don't have to be so closely aligned. Like if your beliefs might be pressed a little bit, your identity's still okay. And I actually think that is a strengthening exercise as well, to see, I'm still okay. I'm still okay. I've talked to someone, they don't agree with me. I'm still okay.
Well, how about following that up? How about talking to like-minded people who get quite apoplectic and get as hateful as they're accusing the others of? So in Braver Angels, we not only have workshops for how to communicate across the divide, we have a workshop called Depolarizing Within. How do you deal with people in your own world who go on rants and who say things that you find compromising your integrity?
It's a great workshop.
Yeah, that does sound like a great workshop. But I wonder, too, there's a lot of talk about civics education. I'm going to toss this first to you, Bill, that, you know, we need to, and there's a place for that, for sure. But listening to the two of you talk, I feel like we need to figure out how to learn how to disagree better, how to, if not argue our point, but be able to enjoy and engage in the kind of give and take of disagreement.
Yes. Yeah, we have workshops for high school students. Some of them are not about politics. It's about school policy.
Sure.
Okay. You know, cell phones, you know, that kind of thing. Things that students differ on and that they can learn and they can practice the things that Leah's talking about that her students were doing. They can practice this around issues that they care about, deliberately using some skills, because our culture does not teach us how to do this. Okay, as Leah, you said, it does not teach us how to do this. And so young people around issues that they care about that are not so tied to identity where it feels like they're compromising some, they can actually work out these skills.
Well, and, you know, it's such an impulse to seek out people that believe exactly what we believe, because it makes us feel good about what we believe, right? Because someone is confirming it back to us. But to actually, Leah, seek out someone who disagrees with us on important issues.
Right, and I just want to say, you know, there are certain time periods where it's harder to do this for certain identities, and I want to be like really put that caveat in, because there are threats, right? There are moments that feel particularly threatening to particular identity groups. And I do tell my students, like, there are times, you know, certain, you know, something happens in the news and it, you know, say something around school shooting, and you don't want to engage on, you know, the gun issue for a little bit. That is so valid. So giving people the permission to not have to bridge constantly. There's moments to bond in you know, your idea, moments to, you know, talk with people who agree with you. But then knowing that, like, that will change, there'll be another opportunity for you then to have another moment to talk to other people. You know, there are, you know, news cycles. There may be certain identities you hold that are fragile or new or something. So I try to create that sense for my students. It's not always all the time. But to what Bill said, yeah, our culture doesn't have a ton of opportunities for just conversation.
Yeah.
So classes I teach, I try to divide into dyads as much as possible. And this concept from Sherry Turkle at MIT that conversation cures. I love that. Like, more conversation cures many times. You know, to not always think of it as a war, that you can work through difficult things with another person, and that can cure things about your own identity and your ideas, you know, to kind of air it.
You know, Bill, I'm thinking I want to take advantage of the fact that you are a clinical psychologist, family therapist, couples and family therapist, and thinking about couples that do disagree about politics. And I wonder, is there something unique about having political disagreements within the family that's different from arguments about money or raising children or who does the dishes? I mean, is there something that kind of sets that apart?
Well, particularly nowadays, with politics and identity and core values being mingled. And so I've worked with a number of couples who were politically mixed couples, and it didn't matter. I mean, somebody was a Republican, a fiscal conservative, but a social liberal, and the other person was whatever. It was never an issue. But this is where the Trump effect has come in. That with families, and I met a marriage therapist who threatened her husband with divorce if he voted for Trump.
Wow.
Oh my, that was 2016. Went, oh my goodness. Okay. So there is something, because we identify politics with such core values, so then you become a stranger to me. By the way, if listeners wanted to see some interviews, so I've done 5 YouTube interviews.
Oh, cool.
With couples divided by politics, and they could just, you know, you can put them on your website. It's Braver Angels, Couples Divided by Politics. And so people who are willing to go on camera and have me kind of coach them through their differences.
No, that's super helpful. How much, Bill, is family of origin, how we were raised, what our parents believed, mm-hmm. or our parent believed, how much of that does that influence what we believe and even our political beliefs and ideals?
Oh, sure. And I'm sure Leah can speak to that.
Sure.
A ton of work on political socialization. Mostly we follow what our parents have done. Mm-hmm. But the strain comes in when you have, like, the parents and most of their adult kids have stayed true. And then you have one who goes off to like Penn somewhere, you know.
Paris for thought, right.
Yeah,
right.
And they change. This creates some difficult family dynamics.
Yeah. You want to speak to that?
Well, no.
All the students at Penn.
Yeah,
right?
It's so interesting to hear. And I my colleagues who study political socialization would know more about this, but you think about certain like TikTok and social media that other generations don't use but that are generationally specific and how socialization happens around social media and that, you know, I'm not exposed to but my children are. I've been thinking a lot about that dynamic as well and how that can work against some of the existing literature we've had about generally, you know, generations and social political socialization. So I think there's some things going on now that might be, you know, challenging some of our existing research. But
yeah, because it keeps you plugged in, right? And it kind of reinforces certain beliefs.
Right. And there's kind of tutorials that go on social media where people are telling you how to believe and what to do if, you know, parents say certain things. So, I mean, it seems kind of new to me, but the existing literature backs what Bill said completely. I just think we're at maybe an inflection point around, you know, socialization. Yeah.
Is the goal then, Bill, to just reduce hostility around polarization? I mean, should that be our goal?
Well, that's the goal we're talking about here. And,
right.
And Leah referred to the term affective, you know, emotional polarization, which I think is a good thing. And again, I'm now channeling, you know, listeners who are saying, but we need to resist certain terrible policies, right? And so I have this little model I use, got three R's: resist, replace, and repair. And so resist is if there's an injustice, you have to fight it, you know, not in illegal ways or unethical ways, but you have to resist. And then, of course, you have to replace it with something. That's, you know, you get Occupy Wall Street. They had no plan. OK, so what do you replace it with? And that's policy. That's other kinds of things. But then the third R is repair, because there's a rending of the social fabric that happens when you have injustices and then fighting back against them. There, you know, look at the Civil War. One of the things I like to say is that the abolitionists resisted, they replaced, you know, with the amendments to the Constitution, but then they went home. We never repaired from the Civil War. And we're still dealing with that now. And so, all three are important. And I've just chosen, in terms of my background and my work, where I'm best suited, and that is the repair.
Right.
You know, how do we repair the social fabric and the relationships? But the other two are important. There needs to be resistance and there needs to be replacement and people thinking through what do we do instead. It's just that what can happen is when people get caught up in resisting, and this is where Trump activates people so much, that it can seem like that's the only thing to do. And that anybody who wants to do what we're talking about here of having people connect, it's a kumbaya. No, we need to fight this war and win it. And some people feel that to actually communicate, as Leah and I are suggesting, is to sell out the resistance. Okay? And I'm saying all three are important at the same time.
And we're almost out of time here, Leah. I want to just give you a chance to respond to that. And I had scribbled notes to myself about, you know, mediators and peacekeepers. I mean, that's obviously dealing with civil wars or actual wars. But I wonder if there aren't things we could learn from those people that are in the trenches.
Yeah, no, I think the easiest thing to do peacekeeper, that's a big, big thing.
Yep.
But an easy thing is just to talk to strangers, and you get to practice when you're talking to strangers. And again, I think it needs to be an invitation in the grocery store and wherever you go. You get to practice empathetic skills that then you can bring home to your, you know, big holiday dinner with different people. You can practice because the stakes are somewhat lower, but it increases your stories, increases your complexity. It's just a way to feel very like you have agency. And you might not necessarily do it. It's easier to look down at your phone in the grocery store line, right? Mm. But to tell yourself there's some value to this, and I want to connect at the grassroots level, one person at a time, talking about the turkey that's in your, you know what I mean, that's in your grocery cart, something, and then going further. So it's a skill that we need to tell people to do more, and that, I think, would build peace.
Well, that's the perfect place to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on The Connection. William Daugherty, thanks so much for joining us from the state of Minnesota. Appreciate it.
Glad to have been with you.
And that's a clinical psychologist, William Daugherty, one of the founders of Braver Angels, an organization that works to bridge the partisan divide. And Leah Howard, thank you for joining us on The Connection as well.
My joy and pleasure.
And she is a political scientist, and she heads up the Political Empathy Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, thank you for joining us today on The Connection. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen on the WHYY app. You can follow us, The Connection, on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Check out our website at whyy.org/theconnection for information about upcoming shows and how to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection, the show produced by Debbie Builder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Happy Merry Holidays from all of us at The Connection. Hope you'll have time to be with people that you love.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.